He has raised from the dead a counterfeit of Christ's resurrection and becomes the supreme ruler, the Antichrist. He quickly assumes the leadership over all. Empowered by the devil, he puts down all rule, authority, and power. It is this stage of his miraculous career of which Daniel 11:40 of our present lesson speaks. He is portrayed as showing his authority, demonstrating his prowess. He overcomes the world. The famed conquest of Alexander fades into insignificance before the onward sweep of this giant. Napoleon's rapid rise and marvelous leadership has been likened to that of the Antichrist. He is a foreshadow, but as to the reality, he is an ant beside an elephant when compared with this despot. There has never been yet any man like this man of devilish origin. Satanic skill added to consummate nerve, diplomacy, cunning, and generalship will characterize his every move. He will be unique, distinct, irresistible, and unconquerable for 1260 days, 42 months, a time, times, and half a time, or 3.5 years, a destined, marked off period of time. At the beginning of his reign, many of the nations are against his supremacy, yet at the end he is victorious over all. Although there is a hint that three countries escape, Edom, Moab, and Ammon. The description given of the terrible conflict in verse 40 is suggestive of an engagement of aerial, naval, and land forces, whirlwind, chariots, and ships. All the combined forces of the world's devastating artillery are used to halt the onward conquering tread of this Superman, but it is in vain. He shall overflow and pass over all lands, subduing and conquering everywhere. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon. Daniel 11, verse 41. We read, he shall enter also into the glorious land. Palestine will not escape his dominating influence. This country was also the objective of Antiochus. He sought to bring the Jews a new religion. He wanted to force upon them his choice of a god and make them worship at his shrine. Likewise, the great usurping counterfeit, the Antichrist. He will enter the land of delight and overcome the people, forcing the Jews to worship his image under threat of death. He will stop all worship of the true and living God, taking away all that reminds men of the true Christ and the cross, causing all sacrifice and oblation to cease. Daniel 9:27. The latter edict is different from that of taking away the daily sacrifice. Daniel 8:11. The daily sacrifice refers to the burnt offering, Leviticus 6, verses 9 through 13, which was to be burning continually upon the altar. The Jews, upon being reinstated to their land, acknowledged as a nation, and having their own religious worship, will immediately commence the Old Testament ordinances relating to the worship of Jehovah. The Mosaic ritual will be restored with its multitudinous shedding of blood and offering up of sacrifices. But when the nations make a covenant with the Jews, the daily burnt offering ceases. It is taken away 30 days before the beginning of the 7 years of usurpation. This surrender of the burnt offering, which speaks more emphatically of Christ and his intrinsic holiness than all of the other offerings, is the signal for God's surrender of them. They turn to the Antichrist, accepting him and his protection rather than Christ, preferring to lean upon the arm of flesh rather than the divine arm. We say that is the reason they are given up into the hands of the world despot, because they gave up the daily burnt offering. Later on, when the satanic monster has come into his place of exaltation and is setting himself up as God, he forbids all sacrifices. In other words, the Jewish religion is set aside. Everyone is commanded to worship this man and his image, which he sets up in some miraculous manner in the temple. That will be the fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy, Daniel 12, verse 11, of which Jesus warns in Matthew 24, 15. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps, Daniel 11, 43. Not only is all the national power at his command, but all the wealth of the world also. He can draw upon all the banks, all the money in the vaults is at his disposal. All the precious things of the earth are given into his hands for these 3.5 years of his undisputed sway. Yet there comes a change. His time is short. Tidings out of the east and north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. Daniel 11:44. Startling news reaches the Antichrist when he appears secure and at ease, having accomplished all that he has hoped and planned. Trouble in the north and east arise, and it rouses the beast to ferocious fury. He appears to vent his wrath upon the people, destroying many. But whether the Jews are meant is not clear, though the next verse might incline to this inference. Anyway, there is trouble on the scene. The north, Syria, and the east, Chaldea, seem to be the storm centers, though we believe that these countries will be otherwise known at the end. A larger view of all these countries in the vicinity of Palestine is demanded by the marvelous statements of scriptures of later writers. The world has grown since Daniel's time, but be this as it may, we are confronted here with the fact that the false ruler of the end will brook no interference from friend or foe. He resists every attack that is against his purposes. His objective now is the Holy Land and to reign there as God Almighty. Therefore we read, "And he shall plant the tabernacle of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain, and he shall come to his end, and none shall help him." Daniel 11, verse 45. From verse 43, we saw that the king of the south and the king of the north were not in league against the king, for he conquers Egypt, but were rather antagonistic toward each other. In Egypt, he is very materially enriched, not only in honor, but in wealth and worship. The Libyans and the Ethiopians yield to him, but all are not yet in perfect submission to him. He hastens to put down all rule and authority and power. He is wrathful that any should be in rebellion against him. He goes to destroy and utterly to make away many, referring no doubt to Israel. Verse 45 further enlightens us as to verse 44, where in a few words it describes the final enthronement of the Antichrist. His palace is planted between the seas and the Holy Land, Jerusalem, no doubt, being the capital of his kingdom. There he meets his doom. The Apostle John on the Isle of Patmos gives us a graphic view of that time of conflict. "And he gathered them together into a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon," Revelation 16:16. The meaning of Armageddon is hill of slaughter. It is from the Hebrew Harmageddon, a compound word composed of Har and Megiddo. Mount Megiddo lies on the southern edge of the plain of Esdraelon, or the Valley of Jehoshaphat, otherwise known as the Valley of Jezreel. It is here where many historic battles were fought and many victories won. The last great onslaught upon Israel is a mustering of the Gentile nations in a common purpose to destroy Israel and get possession of the land of destiny, the homeland of the Jew. The poor people will not be able to take the field against the combined forces of Antichrist, but will resist the armies of the Gentiles and stand against them in the holy city. It is then that the final assault will be made, and it is then that the Lord will fight for his people. The Antichrist, the final destroyer of Israel, will come to his end, and none shall help him. Many prophetical glimpses of that time and scene may be found. the miraculous deliverance. And at the time of the end shall Michael stand up, the great prince, which standeth for the children of thy people. And there shall be a time of trouble such as there never was since there was a nation even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. Daniel 12, verse 1. By these opening words of Daniel 12, we are plainly taught that this is simply the continuation of the words of the divine messenger to Daniel. He is still instructing him as to the final issue. The time of trouble is not a happening, long and distinct from the conflicts described in the end of the preceding chapter, but is said at that time. He is speaking of the end, the objective of all the prophecies vouchsafed to Daniel, as we have noted time and again. Daniel does not disclose to us much of the Messiah's reign of glory, but brings us right up to that point. He shows us that which will introduce it, giving us the execution of judgment that precedes the setting up of the kingdom, without furnishing much of the details. Other prophets emphasize the details. At that time, that crisis time in the history of Daniel's people, they shall be given supernatural help. The angel is encouraging the prophet. In view of all the calamities that have been disclosed to him, he needs these final words. He is informed that when they shall have come to their wits' end, God will fight for these people of destiny. Michael, the great prince, shall stand up to their help. There will come a turning point in their history. It will not be just a little victory, a providential temporary deliverance, but a complete, perfect, and miraculous overthrow of all the enemies of Daniel's people. Michael, the great angelic warrior, will stand up for them, undertaking their case and definitely putting down all their adversaries. It will be the greatest battle that was ever fought. Nothing equal to it has ever been known. Michael is said to be their prince. He was the habitual defender of Israel, their guardian angel, as it were, but now he arises with all the combined celestial army to complete the purpose of God concerning their deliverance. It is an unparalleled hour in the history of Israel. It is their hour of triumph. After centuries of defeat, oblivion, and misfortune, they shall come into victory, fame, and fortune. The tide will turn, the dawn will break, and their ship will come home laden with all blessings for them. It will be their hour of conquest, of what their prophets have written and their singers have sung. Never again will they be the hunted, the tossed about, the downtrodden, the exiled nation without a country. No, indeed. The clock will strike the hour of their resurrection. The dry bones will then begin to shake, and there will be a great awakening. Ezekiel 37. Israel will arise from the ashes, put off her garments of heaviness, put on her garments of salvation and praise, and with joy shall sing as she never sang before. Michael shall stand up to their help, and he will not sheathe his sword nor sit down until Israel has been vindicated and revenged upon the devil for all the wrong which has been inflicted upon them for centuries. John gives us the parallel of this great battle in his symbolic, inspired drama of the end. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels and prevailed not. Neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out, and his angels with him. Revelation 12, verses 7 through 9. The war described in the above citation is in heaven, not in the immediate presence of God, but somewhere in the vast expanse above the earth. There are spheres of vast extent, stories in the heavens, builded by the great Creator. Amos 9, verse 6. Some of which have been ruled over by Satan and his organized forces of wicked spirits. These spirits must all be overthrown and hurled down before Christ can have absolute sway there. This war in heaven precedes the one on earth. It is that which leads up to it. When Satan is cast down, he is wrathy indeed. His power is waning. He must make one last desperate effort to control the situation and hold his ground and his power over men on the earth. It is he that stirs up the nations in a combined struggle to exterminate the Jews, because it is through them that Christ shall reign over the earth. He is the King of the Jews. Men have forgotten this and have sought their downfall and ruin as instigated by the devil, but they shall ultimately triumph. When Satan is bound for 1,000 years, the King of the Jews shall reign supreme. But Satan will fight hard, resisting with all his mighty power and refusing to surrender. Hence, there is trouble which has never had a precedent. Jeremiah describes it in emphatic language. Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it. Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 7. It is the travail time of Israel, her birth pangs, as it were, from which will come forth a nation newborn to reign, a nation purged and glorious, a kingdom of priests that shall bring blessing to the whole world. The prophets marveled at their visions of the miraculous happenings of those days. Isaiah exclaimed, "Who hath heard such a thing? Shall the earth bring forth in a day, or shall a nation be born at once? For as soon as Zion travailed, she brought forth her children." Isaiah chapter 66, verse 8. "And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book." This positive affirmation by the angel forbids the teaching that is prevalent in some quarters, that all the natural lineage of Abraham, living and dead, good or bad, shall be saved. That teaching is a travesty of God's justice. It would make him weaker and more pusillanimous in his judgment than the most feeble of men. The deliverance and resurrection is for those who believe, as in the case of every individual. God cannot save any rebel. The nation will all be newborn, but as for the people, they will be contrite and humbled beforehand. They will be a new creation, a holy seed, a spiritual people. The following verse amplifies and elucidates the subject. "Many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt." Daniel 12, verse 2. This is a scriptural statement of immense scope. There is a millennium in its embrace. The many of Israel that awaken to everlasting life precede the many that awaken to shame and contempt by 1,000 years. We have a parallel of the above in the Gospel of John. The Lord states the fact of the resurrection, saying, "Marvel not at this, for the hour is coming in which all that are in their graves shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and shall come forth. They that have done good unto the resurrection of life," the beginning of the millennium, "and they that have done evil unto the resurrection of damnation," the end of the millennium. John chapter 5, verses 28 and 29. The latter must appear before the great white throne when all the wicked of the world, Jew and Gentile, will come into judgment. But the point that stands out is the fact that there is going to be a resurrection. That was comforting to Daniel, for his heart was torn with conflicting thoughts as he heard the messenger's revelation of the trouble and sorrow, added to the terrible war which would sweep thousands of his people into their graves. The news must have overwhelmed him. He needed the comforting message of the resurrection. Israel's faithful dead shall come forth out of their graves and participate in the glorious kingdom of the Son of Man. But these shall not be part of the earthly population. They will have their glorified bodies and may visit and reign over the earth, but this will not be their abiding place. The Savior declared that in the millennium the 12 apostles shall sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of restored Israel. Matthew 19:28. He also stated that Many shall come from the east and from the west, and shall sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of God. Matthew 8, verse 11. The earthly people will not enjoy their glorified bodies until the end of the millennium. Therefore, we see that there are ranks in the resurrection of Israel. Some of the worthies of faith, of Old Testament fame, were raised up when Christ tore the bars of death away and arose from the dead. Those have been in heaven for almost two millenniums already. They constitute the first rank, the full overcomers of their day. They obtained a better resurrection, Hebrews 11:35. The second rank will arise when Christ will appear and call them out of their graves. But the restored nation will not enjoy their resurrection bodies until the end of Christ's 1,000-year reign. The duration of life will be extended in that halcyon period upon the earth. The obedient people of Jehovah will live right through to the end of the beneficent and righteous reign of Messiah, but the unruly and rebellious will find an early grave. There will be no toleration of wickedness. Judgment will be summarily meted out upon the offender. Righteousness instead of grace will be the manifestation of that throne. In that day there will be no unjust judges, no taking of bribes, no covering up of crime and lawlessness. Laws will be made and they will be enforced by all. The rich cannot break them and avoid the consequences any more than the poor. If men obey and yield, there will be no death, no sorrow, and no tears. These are not our thoughts on the subject. We read that there shall be no more the death of an infant of days, nor of an old man who has not filled up his days, unless he has transgressed the laws of the kingdom. For the child shall die 100 years old, but the sinner, being 100 years old, shall be accursed. Isaiah 65, verse 20. That is, in the renewed earth, no one shall die as the result of Adam's sin. Babes that are not responsible die now, but then no child will fall into an untimely grave. Death will only come upon the individual that is responsible for his own transgressions, and it will be the sign of his eternal judgment. 100 years seems to be the limit of their probation. If they fail after that, they will find no mercy here or hereafter. Shining ones, and they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars for ever and ever. But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. Daniel 12, verses 3 and 4. These wise ones refer exclusively to Daniel's people, for that is all that he understands. He knows nothing of the church and the wisdom of Christ that is accorded her. Therefore, we must look at these things from the prophet's standpoint. There will be some men of understanding that shall instruct others. There were some in those former days, men that had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do. 1 Chronicles 12:32. Also in the days of the Maccabees, the understanding ones did instruct many. Daniel 11:33. There will be some wise ones in the still darker days of the apostasy, when the Lord's hand will be against Israel, and he will allow the superhuman atrocities and tribulation which the Antichrist will mete out to them. It will be these loyal, shining souls, these spiritual teachers, that will instruct, exhort, and stay the believing remnant of that end time. They shall shine amidst the darkness as a beacon light, and later their glory and light will be manifested to the whole world. Whether they will be the adornment of the nation in the celestial or in the terrestrial sphere is not so clear or pertinent. The fact that they shine in the dark night of Israel's apostasy is the principal thing. These shining ones will turn many ignorant, tempted, weak, and wavering Israelites to righteousness. This is the case at any time and in every age. Yet the application here is to the crisis time in Israel's history, their hour of crucial testing just before the Lord returns. The command to Daniel was to shut up the words and seal the book even to the time of the end, which refers also to the same trying period. Daniel obeyed the command. His prophecy was sealed until the present century. The nation did not understand the prophecy. The veil was upon their heart, but in their hour of need they shall understand. Many shall run to and fro. They shall run through the pages of Daniel, search the scriptures to find the deep things. Ah, when once the Jews' eyes are open, there will come some such rich findings of hidden treasures, such illumination as few Christians have ever found. They will not sit listless and inattentive as the word is given out. We can imagine with what interest they will run through the book of books, and with what shouts and deep exclamations of praise they will punctuate their findings. No dry theoretical study for those interested Hebrews. They will besiege those that are enlightened as to the scriptures, not to ascertain which theory of Daniel is correct, but to know the truth. The cry of their hearts will be, "What does the prophet teach as to the end?" There will be no question as to what Professor Deep Man or Dr. Wiseman understands, but what has Daniel to say? It will be too late to run to and fro through all the books on Daniel, but the one book they will search. Knowledge shall be increased. Yes, indeed, wisdom and knowledge are truly increased and built up by a learning of the scriptures. The Jews will understand the situation. They will find that the end is at hand, and they will rest in hope as to the issue. The closing wonders. Then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, there stood other two, the one on this side of the bank, and the other on that side of the bank of the river. And one said to the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, "How long shall it be to the end of these wonders?" And I heard the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his left hand unto heaven and swear by him that liveth forever, that it shall be for a time, times, and a half. And when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished. And I heard, but understood not. And I said, "O my Lord, what shall be the end of these things?" Daniel 12, verses 5 through 7. At this point in his vision, Daniel appears simply as an auditor on the scene. There are two other persons present beside the glorious man that has been with Daniel since the beginning of the vision, Daniel 10, verse 5. The latter personage appears above or on the bosom of the river Hiddekel, or Tigris as it is now called. The other two men are standing on the bank of the river, one on the right and the other on the left side. One of these visitants calls to the man upon the waters, "How long until the end of these wonders?" Observe the answer. It is given by the one addressed in the most solemn, authoritative manner, clearly impressing us with the majesty and dignity of the speaker. None but the Lord, the Son of God, could so speak. Although he had not yet become incarnate, he is seen here as the man of wondrous destiny, ordained to the fullest sovereignty over land and sea. We have a like scene, symbolic of the same person and same time to which Daniel's vision points, the end, Revelation 10, verses 1 through 7. The man in both instances lifts up his hands, but only Daniel tells us that he swears by him that liveth forever, and that 3.5 years shall be the exact time in which these closing wonders shall be consummated. This period is already familiar to Daniel, for he has heard it emphasized before, but it is recorded here as the answer to the man's question. The time agrees exactly in length and purpose with the inspired statements of Daniel 7:25 and 9:27. It refers to the time when the Antichrist shall have absolute power in his hands and shall destroy, devastate, and scatter the people of the Lord, the Jews. As we have noted earlier, he will have a loose rein for that length of time. God will allow it for the chastening of his people. But when his purpose is accomplished, he will suddenly put an end to the false despot and his kingdom. For that determined time, 3.5 years, the Jews will be at their wits' end, utterly and absolutely helpless, shut up to the mercy of God. It will surely be evident in that case that man's extremity is God's opportunity. Grace alone will be their hope in that terrible time. They will learn the hopelessness of trusting the flesh, not only their own, but all flesh. Their willpower, self-righteousness, wealth, and wisdom shall be seen to be valueless in the face of the despotic tyranny of the oppressor. No might of man of whatever character can save them. God alone will be found able to extricate them from their dilemma. They will do some calling upon the Lord then, not with their mouth only, but with their heart. No more will they approach him in a formal, lifeless manner, but their whole being will be moved with travail and tears. They will cry even as Daniel cried, O Lord, hear! O Lord, forgive! O Lord, hearken and do! Defer not for thine own sake, O my God, for thy city and thy people are called by thy name. Daniel 9, verse 19. The whole of this prayer is the cry of the humbled, contrite Jewish remnant of that time. Listen to the broken spirit, the weakness, and the confession of failure expressed therein. And I set my face to seek by prayer and supplication with fasting and sackcloth and ashes. That will be the character of their approach to Jehovah. Then notice the words. We have sinned. We have not hearkened to the prophets. O Lord, righteousness belongeth unto thee, but unto us confusion of faces as at this day. We have not obeyed the voice of the Lord our God. Yea, all Israel have transgressed thy law. Therefore the curse is poured out upon us, the oath that is written in the law of Moses, because we have sinned against him. He has confirmed his words which he spake against us. The Lord watched upon the evil and brought it upon us, for the Lord is righteous in all his works. Daniel 9, verses 3 through 14. There is not one word of pride in any form in that prayer. It speaks of the abased and humbled condition of the remnant of the Jews at the end. The Lord will preserve a third part of the nation through the tribulation and plant them as a seed in the renewed earth when he is king. Their cry to him, O, that thou wouldest rend the heavens, that thou wouldest come down, that the mountains might flow down at thy presence, will be answered. Isaiah 64:1. He will come down and deliver them forever from the hand of the enemy. And it shall be said in that day, Lo, this is our God. We have waited for him, and he will save us. We will be glad and rejoice in his salvation. Isaiah 25:9. The Lord will graciously lend his ear to such pleading. He hath declared that they should not see him henceforth until they should say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. Matthew 23, verse 39. But when they humble themselves, he will look even to him that is of a poor and contrite spirit and trembleth at my word. Isaiah 66:2. Daniel heard the conversation between the heavenly visitors, but he did not understand the meaning of the answer. He cried out to be enlightened, O my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? But the messenger does not endeavor to make it any clearer for him. It was not the time for him to understand. He would not be on earth when these wonders would transpire. Hence, it was not necessary for him to understand everything. But for the people of the end, of which he is the type, there will come the opening of the prophecy, even as unto us at the present time. But to Daniel there was given these parting words, Go thy way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Many shall be purified and made white and tried. But the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. Daniel 12, verses 9 and 10. Daniel is assured by the messenger that he is a prophet. His words shall stand till the time of the end. They were sealed up for many centuries. The Jews did not understand the prophecy, even as Daniel himself. It relates altogether to the time of the end as to its revelation. The positive guarantee of the messenger is given with uplifted hand that all that is declared to Daniel shall be fulfilled. Then he reiterates the substance of the last vision and emphasizes it by repetition. Many of the people shall suffer, and their faith shall be tried in the furnace of affliction, even as the three Hebrew lads. A little earnest of this later fiery trial. They too shall come forth in victory, restored to God, separated, conquered, and purified by the fanning mill. They will be the nucleus of the kingdom of Christ upon the earth. But there will be others that will not come forth. It is a question of the heart. None of the wicked shall understand. With the heart man believeth, and God searches the heart. The signs of the times as well as the scriptures will be hidden from them. There will be no fear of the Lord before their face. It is the lack of wisdom that darkens men's hearts. The fiery trial which will melt the wise and prudent will only harden the heart of the foolish. Pharaoh of Egypt is a figure of those that refuse to heed the voice of the Lord. The word they hear but do not heed has the effect of deadening their consciences as well as hardening their hearts and stiffening their necks and knees. They will not repent, though the judgments will be falling fast. The following verses give us two more measurements as to end time events. They are not introduced here haphazardly, but are a part of the vision proper that was interrupted for a little space, as it were. We have had special measurements before. These are just further signposts on the last day's stretch. And from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away, and the abomination that maketh desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he that waiteth and cometh to 1,335 days. But go thy way, Daniel, till the end be, for thou shalt rest and stand in thy lot at the end of the days. Daniel 12, verses 11 through 13. The first of these dates, 1,290 days, is the most important measuring line. Without it, we can hardly get any starting point to these last day happenings. It is therefore a most necessary measurement. The angel says that there will elapse 1,290 days between the date that the daily sacrifice is interrupted and the abomination of desolation is set up. Now we have an earlier revelation concerning the latter fact, Daniel 9:27. We are informed as to exactly when it is set up, in the midst of the week, or 7 years, or 1,260 days. It is absolutely necessary that we get our starting point correct, then the remainder of our study of these time dates will be simplified. The fact that the basic offering, the daily burnt offering, is taken away is in itself of deep significance. But that it happens just 30 days before the covenant with the false prince is ratified is also of great import. The reason that it ceases is not told us, but we easily surmise that the Jews are overruled in the matter, for this offering was always held in great reverence by them. It was considered the principal offering in the Mosaic ritual. It was a continual offering. Day and night there was always a sacrifice burning upon the altar, and the fire was never to be put out or allowed to go out, Leviticus chapter 6, verses 9 and 13. It figures Christ in the excellency of his own perfect character, given up to do the will of God. Lo, I come to do thy will, O God, is the essence of the burnt offering. Hence, for the Jews to give it up was equivalent to the letting go of their faith in the Messiah. It proved that the nation was not believing in the God of their fathers. Yea, more, it was the sign of their apostate condition. According to a principle with God, when men give up their faith in him, and refuse obedience to his commands, he gives them up to their desires, and the retribution which follows is the due reward of their own evil deeds. Romans 1, verses 21 through 25. They can then blame no one but themselves when the trouble comes. Their agreement to stop the burnt offering is, no doubt, the signal that they are no longer under the protection of Jehovah, but have been given up to their own way. As it were, the Lord steps out and allows the Antichrist to step in with all that this signifies to them. The Gentiles will again have the supremacy because the Jews will again reject their Messiah. They will reap what they have sown. However, this time the treading down of Jerusalem will only continue 42 months or 1260 days. God will intervene for the sake of the elect. Otherwise, no flesh should be saved. Matthew 24:22. Speaking to the nation when they rejected his claims, Jesus said, "Another shall come in his own name. Him you will receive." John 5:43. The latter, as one of the heads of the Confederacy of Nations, will make a covenant with them for 7 years, but there will be no stability to this alliance. It will shortly be broken. The usurper will assume great authority, showing himself off as God after his deadly wound has been healed. 2 Thessalonians 2:4. His image will be set up in the temple and worship of it demanded upon the threat of death. Revelation 13. The latter we have seen is the abomination of desolation of which Jesus warned in Matthew 24:15. It marks the beginning of the great tribulation, which latter will never be allowed to come upon them until they reject God's way of salvation by giving up the burnt offering type of sacrifice and blood. Second measuring line, the second date, 1335 days from Daniel 12:12, gives us the very day of Christ's appearing to the Jew. Beginning at the very same time as the tribulation and counting 75 days after its close, the Lord will be revealed to a waiting, humbled people. From the moment that the Antichrist and his false prophet will have been dispatched, the remnant of the Jews that have survived the terrible onslaught of the devil will be in mourning and supplication. Zechariah 12:10. They will call for the one whom they have rejected and say, "Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord." Matthew 21:9. And then he will appear to their delight and everlasting joy. That will happen just 75 days after the Antichrist and false prophet will have been cast alive into the lake of fire. Revelation 19:20. At that point, the Lord will have been seated upon his throne in the heavens for 7 years, waiting to be revealed to his chosen people. Thus, by their unbelief, they will lose that much of the millennium and invite instead the terrible chastisement of the 1260 days, or rather the 1010 days, as the allotted time will be shortened, 250 days. The Jews that will endure to the end of the tribulation will be blessed, Matthew 24:13, for the Lord will appear and take vengeance on their enemies. In his Olivet Discourse, Jesus intimates the blessedness awaiting their enduring. Please fast forward to the end of this tape and turn the tape over. Then the messenger, as he takes leave of Daniel, graciously gives him a word of comfort concerning his own interests at that day of blessing for his people. "Go thy way." It has the sound of a discharge from life's service, and so it was. His wonderful consecrated life, so full of stirring events and great deeds for his God, was at its close. He might well have said, as another aged servant at a later day, "Now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace." Luke 2:29. He had envisioned the sorrow and trial that was coming upon his people. But more, he had caught the vision also for the coming of the Lord to deliver them from sin, transgression, and iniquity, and bring in everlasting righteousness, seal up the vision, and anoint the Most Holy. Daniel 9, verse 24. Hence, his discharge from service is only temporary. He shall stand in his lot and promptly respond at the end of the days to the service call. But in glorified activity, he will then be associated with his beloved people. So we leave him happy in the anticipation of that coming day. He has been faithful in his ordained place here, in a little place, comparatively, we might say. How much greater shall his service be in that glorified place in the kingdom of our Lord Jesus Christ? He will then be rewarded for the things done in his mortal body, even as you and I shall be. But we are loath to leave him. How we have enjoyed running to and fro through his writings, learning about him as we learn to understand his visions. What a man to imitate and his faith to follow. No equivocation, no compromise, no subterfuge. He was clear as the sun, fair as the moon, terrible as an army with banners. His intrepid, burning, fiery zeal moves others to dare to believe the word of God, even in the face of grossest unbelief and darkest night. He overcame in his day and has left us an example which we will all do well to imitate. He lives again in others. This concludes the reading of Sister Mary M. Bodie's Discourses on Daniel, the Interpreter of Dreams.